Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Good afternoon and a warm welcome to Tuesday's Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo with a roundup of social media.
Also on our programme, an analyst's assessment of plans by the Nigerian military to drive Boko Haram out of the Zambeza forest.
We are at the end of the Nigeria rainy season. The wet weather tends to limit the Nigerian military's ability to launch any form of ground offensive. So the timing of the offensive at the very least does conform with the dry season when, you know, such a military incursion is possible.
And US President-elect Donald Trump has released a video in which he vows to dump a key trade pact. We'll be asking how his administration is shaping up.
He does not look like he was really ready to transition to be the president of the United States.
Also in the program, is abortion something to be forgiven? That's a question we asked on Facebook after Pope Francis extended power to priests to forgive abortion.
But first we find out what's been happening around the globe.
I'm Shay Meineke with DW News. Nigerian Boko Haram militants have killed six Cameroon soldiers near a West African League Chad army base, sources said on Tuesday. The assault follows a string of attacks in the League Chad region, where Boko Haram militants have killed nearly 15,000 people during its six-year insurgency. In an attempt to impose strict Islamic Sharia law, the United Nations says Boko Haram has cut off up to 1 million people from humanitarian aid around West Africa's League Chad region. Turning to Syria, rights groups have said hundreds of thousands of civilians remain trapped in the rebel-held city of Aleppo, where airstrikes and renewed fighting between forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and rebel groups have killed thousands of civilians. A spokesman for the UN has described the situation in Aleppo as horrendous.
The situation in eastern Aleppo is really so horrendous. I mean, it's beyond words. I think we're all struggling to say anything new about it because it's so unremittingly awful. Despite the occasional let-ups, overall the picture is horrendous. And the fact that these hospitals and clinics have continuously been hit is a matter of very, very grave concern.
Turkey's ruling AKP party on Tuesday has withdrawn a controversial marriage bill that could legitimize child rape. Though withdrawn, Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim told reporters it would be reviewed by all parties for further discussion. Rights groups have warned the bill could allow sexual predators to avoid punishment and expose sexually assaulted victims to further suffering. The proposal has drawn large protests across the country. This news comes to you from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has said he would quit the Trans-Pacific Partnership on his first day in office. In a video released Tuesday, Trump said the 12-nation trade deal has been a disaster for American jobs.
Today, I would like to provide the American people with an update on the White House transition and our policy plans for the first 100 days. My agenda will be based on a simple core principle, putting America first. On trade, I am going to issue our notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country.
At least 14 people were injured after a 7.4 magnitude earthquake struck off the coast of northeastern Japan early Tuesday. Several aftershocks are still expected. More than 3,000 residents fled to an evacuation center in Fukushima, where Japan's worst nuclear accident claimed thousands of lives in 2011. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the government would respond swiftly to ensure the safety of residents affected by the disaster. And turning to other news, German television productions have won three International Emmy Awards in New York late on Monday. Deutschland 83 won the prestigious Best Drama Award. The film War of Lies won Best Documentary. And German Christiana Paul won the Best Actress Award for her role in Under the Radar. For more news and information, visit our website at dw.com. I'm Shay Meineke.
In Nigeria, the military has released the names and photographs of 55 Boko Haram suspects wanted by the authorities. The move was accompanied by an appeal from the chief of staff for assistance in their capture by the general public. From Abuja, Ben Shemang reports.
Among those declared wanted by the army include Abubakar Shekau, leader of Boko Haram, who the military claimed to have killed 3 times. Now that Boko Haram has been broken into 2 factions, the leader of the new faction, Abu Musa al-Barnawi, who the so-called Islamic State recognized as leader of its West African affiliate, is also on the wanted list. Al-Barnawi is the son of the slain founder of Boko Haram, Mohamed Yusuf. Abu Zinara, who at the point was holding telephone conference with selected journalists as far back as 2014, was also mentioned in the list. In total, the military has so far declared 202 persons wanted since it began fighting the Islamists. Some of the people on the list have died in battle with the military, while others have been arrested and detained.
Ben Shemang reporting. Meanwhile, the Nigerian military also say they're launching what they describe as an operation to flush out Boko Haram from the Zambeze forest, where the group is known to have a stronghold. Now, Boko Haram has shown through a series of attacks recently that it is far from being on its last legs. I asked independent security analyst Ryan Cummings for his assessment of this operation announced by the Nigerian military.
So I think there's enough evidence to suggest that there is sincerity by the Nigerian military when it states it's going to launch a large-scale offensive against the Islamist extremist sect. And I think something which is quite important as well is that we are at the end of the Nigeria rainy season, which is extremely important because the wet weather tends to limit the Nigerian military's ability to launch any form of ground offensive because rain-drenched roads obviously is a major obstacle for mechanized infantry. So the timing of the offensive at the very least does conform with the dry season when, you know, such a military incursion is possible.
The respected Institute for Security Studies said Boko Haram launched 12 strikes against military targets in August, 24 in September, and 22 in October. What does this tell you about their strength?
Again, the number of attacks also speaks to the environmental conditions within northeast Nigeria, as much as the Nigerian military would have been debilitated from operational perspective by the northeastern rainy season, so would Boko Haram. Secondly, we also note that the targeting of violence by Boko Haram seems to be very specific and more discriminate at this stage, you know, focusing on military assets and personnel. And I think the reason for this is that we've recently seen a schism within the organization itself, where we saw Abu Musa al-Barnawi, who is the self-acclaimed leader of Boko Haram and who has the backing of the Islamic State, to which the group pledged allegiance in March 2015, versus a separate Boko Haram faction under the leadership of Abubakar Shekau. It seems that intrinsic to the split in the group has been Shekau's faction, or under his leadership, you know, these attacks that have targeted civilian settlements and civilian interests. It's been claimed as being un-Muslim for him to do so, and it's this mass atrocities that has purportedly seen the Islamic State lose favor with Shekau and vest their support behind al-Barnawi.
Independent security analyst Ryan Cummings. US President-elect Donald Trump has said in a video that his agenda will be based on a simple core principle: putting America first. He reiterated a number of his promises for his first 100 days and has already vowed to abandon the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Ole Tangen Jr. is a US journalist here at Deutsche Welle, and I asked him what America was making of all this.
Well, I think most Americans are a bit wondering what this whole idea of putting America first. I think every American president that has ever been elected to that office has put America first. At the same time, it's been something that he has continually repeated throughout his campaign, and it's not surprising to hear him say this on this, his first video message to the American people since being elected. In terms of trade, he has talked that he is going to abandon the TPP on his first day in office. And this is a trade pact with 12 countries that border the Pacific Ocean, including Japan, Mexico, and Australia. Absent from this agreement is China, which has been his main point of criticism, is American trade pacts with or trade relationships with China. That is absent from his rhetoric. So it's going to be interesting seeing how he's going to move forward, not just on things like the TPP, but also on how America is going to deal with trade with their number one trade partner, which is China.
Now, missing from his list of promises is his pledge to repeal the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and his vow to build a southern border wall with Mexico. Are those omissions raising eyebrows?
It's always easy to make promises during a campaign, and then it's harder to follow through with these promises once you are in office. So I think he had already made clear in an interview on 60 Minutes that there are some parts of the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act that he agrees with, including having an option for people with pre-existing conditions, health conditions, to get health care, and that they were perhaps trying to see if they can come up with an option to Obamacare rather than just repeal it outright. And of course, a southern wall being built with Mexico costs a lot of money. There's a lot of questions of eminent domain. Who owns the land where this wall is going to be built? There's a lot of issues there. And again, it sounded really good to a lot of Americans during the campaign, but it's going to be a lot harder to execute once he is now president.
How much progress has the president-elect made towards putting together his administration? And how much more time does he have?
Well, he has until January 20th to put together his administration. And a lot of people who are watching how transition is happening are concerned. He does not look like he was really ready to transition to be the president of the United States.
Ole Tangen Jr. Burundi is embroiled in a political and humanitarian crisis. People are fleeing the country to escape the violence, and more than 500,000 are short of food. It's against this backdrop that the country has just sworn in a new ombudsman. Expectations as to what he could achieve in such a divided country are modest, as Apollinaire Niora reports.
Moi, Honorable Edouard Nduimana,
I, Honorable Edouard Nduimana, swear allegiance to the President of the Republic, to the National Constitution, and to the laws of Burundi. I swear and promise to accomplish my duties with honesty and impartiality, and to uphold any information during and after my assignment in confidence.
Que j'aurai obtenu pendant et après l'exercice de mes fonctions.
That was new Ombudsman Edouard Nduimana making his oath at Kigobe Parliament House before Burundi's top leaders and diplomats accredited to Burundi. But the vice chairman of FRODEBU opposition party, Leonce Ngendakumana, said Nduimana won't bring any change.
There is nothing we can expect from the new ombudsman. I say this referring to his history. Upon becoming Kayanza governor, he suspended the FRODEBU for 6 months without any reason. When he became the Home Affairs Minister, he divided the party into FRODEBU and FRODEBU Nyakuri.
Edouard Nduimana, a Tutsi from Kayanza province, is going to serve a 6-year term as the second ombudsman of Burundi in replacement of Mohamed Rukara, another Tutsi whose term has ended. Before his new assignment as Burundi's ombudsman, Nduimana was the second vice speaker of the National Assembly. Previously, he was the Home Affairs Minister and the Governor of the Northern Province of Kayanza.
Apollinaire Niora reporting from Burundi.
We posted an article on our DW Africa Facebook page. And by the way, we are almost nearing 50,000 likes since we launched on October 31st. So thanks to all those who have been visiting the page and interacting. Anyway, we put up this article about Pope Francis extending to priests the power to forgive abortion.
Abortion, a touchy issue for some.
Very, very touchy issue. Dennis Ringasma said, in his opinion, he thinks it's a step in the right direction. Isaac Ehosa Godwin commented, abortion will help control overpopulation. But he also added that it should be done by qualified practitioners. Of course, there were some who didn't agree with the Pope, such as Neil Izor. He plainly asked, is Pope God?
All right, as I said earlier, it's a touchy issue for some.
Another story which seemed to get our Facebook users talking was the fact that Nigeria is now officially in recession. Africa's biggest economy has been hit hard by low oil prices and attacks on oil infrastructure.
You're listening to Africa Link. Coming up here on Africa Link, Thuli Madonsela tells Deutsche Welle what it's like to investigate the president of South Africa.
There were elements that kept asking me to either drop the investigation, the last one, or rather to do a broader investigation into state capture, but there was no basis to do anything broader.
And the hashtag DoomPasta has been trending, so stick around to find out why.
But first, we head to Zimbabwe, where tensions are rising over the imminent introduction of bond notes. That's a quasi-currency which is officially supposed to alleviate the chronic shortage of cash in the country. However, many Zimbabweans fear it is an attempt to reinstate the discredited Zimbabwean dollar through the back door. Despite such misgivings, the notes are set to go into circulation in 8 days' time. From Harare, Privilege Mushaniri reports.
Bond notes, rewarding every contribution in foreign currency generation. For more information, contact our...
Adverts like these are currently running on radio and television on a daily basis to promote the new bond note currency. This comes amid fierce debates in homes and public places for and against the promissory notes. In some instances, the debates have ended up in physical fights. The message is clear and loud. Most Zimbabweans do not trust the government anymore. Many fear this new bond note could easily take the trend of the Zimbabwean dollar, which has lost its value and was eventually scrapped. At its lowest ebb in 2009, the Zimbabwean dollar traded at a hyperinflation rate of 5,000%, meaning 100 trillion Zimbabwean dollar was exchanged for one US dollar. The US dollar, South African rand, the British pound, Indian rupee, Japanese yen and Chinese yuan then became the de facto legal tenders. The coming of the bond note has triggered panic cash withdrawals. People are sleeping in queues in front of banks to be counted among the few lucky ones the next day to withdraw cash.
I want to collect it all because there's no need for me to keep it in the bank. Because it's pointless, because I will not see it again if I leave it there. So I need to collect it all.
Where the economy is going now, we have this fear of bond notes. If we don't take our money now, it's US dollars. So we are not going to get US dollars. We'll be now getting bond notes. So we have to take our money then.
Simba Chitembwe, a 35-year-old security guard, and Lloyd Chauna, a 30-year-old forklift driver, have braved the late-night rain drizzle to access cash. According to the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, John Magundia, the bond notes are an incentive for exporters and believe the public does not understand it.
The purpose of bond notes is to deal with an incentive for exporters. But I think people are now confusing that the bond notes are coming here to cater for cash shortages. No, there's no relationship.
The desperate push to introduce bond notes has spawned a host of jokes on social media. Comedians and individuals are finding their own way of ridiculing the impending currency.
Here at The Week, we can exclusively reveal to you what the bond notes will look like as we manage to get a prototype leaked to us by a patriotic low friend in a high place.
One is Sidi Efatso, a popular local comedian who made a parody of the yet-to-be-revealed security features of the bond notes in his show that runs under the name This Week.
So it can help you at any roadblock. In the middle, you'll see the serial numbers, and the serial number is 007, because it's a bond note, huh? James Bond. Hey? So all of them will have the same serial numbers.
Citizens' movements have fiercely resisted the introduction of the bond notes. Street protests and court challenges have been mounted, but the government is not backing down. President Robert Mugabe used his presidential powers on October 31st to amend the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe and designated the unpopular new bank notes as legal tender that will be equivalent to the US dollar. The group Zimbabwe's Lawyers for Human Rights have asked the High Court to strike down the decree by Mugabe, saying it is unconstitutional. The case is yet to be heard.
Attentive listeners will, of course, recognise the voice of Abubakar Jolo. That was not Privilege Mushaniri. Privilege, though, did write that story, and we had to read it for you for technical reasons.
Africa on the move.
Until the middle of October, Thuli Madonsela was South Africa's public protector or ombudswoman. Her diligence and courage in investigating the affairs of the mighty and the powerful earned her much respect and popularity in South Africa. Before her tenure came to an end, she'd been investigating President Jacob Zuma and whether he had permitted the wealthy Indian Gupta family to wield undue influence over the presidency. Thuli Madonsela's fame has spread abroad, and she's the recipient of this year's German Africa Prize. My colleague Amrit Chima across at Deutsche Welle Television asked her how President Zuma had reacted to her investigations.
President Zuma has reacted well to many investigations that I've done. But, of course, the last two I did relating to him, he reacted not as I expected him to.
You were appointed by him in this post as public protector. Did you feel a sense of kind of fear, intimidation and threats from him or his government once you launched these investigations of corruption against him?
Certainly not from him and not from government directly. But yes, there were elements that kept asking me to either drop the investigation, the last one, or rather to do a broader investigation into state capture. But there was no basis to do anything broader than what we had been asked to do.
So how did you react to these suggestions?
The normal way is we investigate when there's a basis to investigate. As the Public Protector is an institution that it receives grievances and resolves grievances regarding state action. And before we investigate, we look at whether or not there's a basis to investigate. And in this particular context, we did exactly the same thing. And I found no basis for broadening the investigation beyond what I had been asked to investigate.
Because your role is a very powerful one. It's a 7-year term, and the decisions taken by your office are binding. Is that right?
Certainly. It is like a European ombudsman, but with more powers in terms of being able to investigate on own initiative, and secondly, having binding decisions. And thirdly, it can investigate the acts of anyone who is operating in terms of state power or control over public resources, from a cleaner who works for the state to the president.
Now, many people have had your position before as public protector, but you've given it new power. Now, many people in South Africa, I've been told, would like you to run for public office. Would you consider that? Tell us on DW. Yes.
Well, absolutely no interest in public office. But I must also say that it hasn't been my work only. It's been the work of the public protector team and the whistleblowers who have worked with us, plus cooperation from the government of South Africa and the judiciary.
And what is the biggest challenge you faced in your job?
I think the major challenge was not having adequate resources. And the second challenge was some people not understanding our powers properly, because it is a new institution. And it was often difficult for people to understand that we can order somebody senior in government to do something. Of course, we do so nicely.
Now, you've come here to Berlin to receive the German Africa Prize. Congratulations for that. But what kind of impact do these prizes have on your work in South Africa?
I think the prizes have had an impact of affirming the work that has been done by the Public Protector of South Africa and profiling the Public Protector as an institution. For me personally and my team, it has been a bit of a vindication. Although we didn't do our work for prizes, we did our work in terms of telling the truth the best we knew how.
And a final question for you, Thuli. Now, you're from the ANC, the governing party. What do you make of the direction the ANC is going to?
Well, I think the ANC has a right to do whatever it needs to do. But ultimately, the test of whether the ANC or any other party in South Africa will survive or not is the extent to which it keeps to the spirit and not just the letter of the constitution and delivers to the people of South Africa the constitutional dream without anybody being left behind.
South Africa's former public protector, Thuli Madonsela, talking to Amrita Chima.
Focus Europe.
Focus Europe this week takes us to France, where a weekly radio show on human sexuality is attracting audiences among communities from North and Sub-Saharan Africa. The show is broadcast by Beur FM and is co-hosted by Nadia Elbourga. There are no taboos on her programme, as we hear in this report from Lisa Bryant in Paris.
ABS à votre santé. Bonjour, bienvenue, ravi de vous retrouver. Vous le savez, jusqu'à 13h, on s'occupe de votre forme sous toutes les formes sur Beurre FM. Et le mardi, nous avons le plaisir de retrouver Nadia El-Bouga. Bonjour.
Bonjour Philippe.
Sage-femme, sexologue, clinicienne.
Nadia El-Bouga is talking about the long-term scars of FGM, or female genital mutilation. The women she's treated who can't enjoy sex, who suffer from medical complications, who may even have forgotten the painful event they underwent when they were as young as 4.
They didn't even know what excision was. They found out during their first gynecological exam. It's absolutely not a prescription from the Quran or the Prophet.
El-Bouga is seated at the Paris studio of Beurre FM. She features in a weekly radio show on sexuality, hosted by French reporter Philippe Robichon, that draws audiences as far as North and Sub-Saharan Africa.
Alors les objectifs et les missions pour les comprendre, en fait, il faut remonter juste.
FGM, the subject of this week's topic, has been performed on roughly 200 million women and girls worldwide, including up to 60,000 in France. The show also features Marion Schaefer, who works for an NGO fighting to end it.
Ablation partielle ou totale du clitoris. Le type 2, c'est l'excision.
She's talking about different forms of FGM, but also clinics in France that repair the clitoris. For some Beurre FM listeners, FGM is a taboo topic, but no subject seems off limits for El-Bouga. Elegantly dressed in a pink headscarf and black pants, the 39-year-old Muslim sexologist and midwife mixes medical facts with a dose of religious reality.
Votre magazine santé tous les jours, midi 13h, sur Beurre FM.
Premature ejaculation, homosexuality, pedophilia, and masturbation all are fair game during El-Bouga's weekly radio shows. The mother of two is not only challenging conservative Muslim conventions, but also stereotypes about Islam held by non-Muslims. When El-Bouga talks, activist Schaefer says, people listen.
Ils diront, elle est musulmane pratiquante, elle connaît les grands textes, si elle nous dit que c'est pas écrit.
People will think she's a practicing Muslim who knows Islamic texts. With someone like me who's not a Muslim, they may reject the message.
Mosques and women's groups are soliciting El-Bouga to talk about sexuality. Media are beginning to cover her. Beurre FM reporter Robichon met her through a friend.
Elle est toujours en avance par rapport aux gens, par rapport au sujet.
Nadia is always ahead of the curve. She challenges me all the time to take on subjects I think are completely implausible. Sometimes I wonder how listeners will respond. But with Nadia, it's completely natural. She calls things like they are.
Her message to Muslims and non-Muslims alike, yes, it's possible to be a sexologist and a practicing Muslim. There is no contradiction.
Lisa Bryant in Paris.
Mark, the trending topic on Twitter in South Africa is about the Doom Pastor or Doom Prophet. Pastor Letebo Rabalago of the Mount Zion General Assembly Church in Limpopo has been spraying his congregants with the Doom insecticide, saying it has the power to heal their sicknesses.
What's been the reaction from Twitter users?
Well, shock, anger, empathy, humour and more. Take, for example, this tweet from Sfamandla Helengwa. He says, as Africans, we have accepted a religion that makes us look like fools in the eyes of the world, but we have neglected our ancestors. There are also lots of Twitter users who posted pictures of themselves with Doom and making fun of the pastor and the congregants. One of the pictures, which I found hilarious, is from student Siboniso Mnikathi. He posted a supermarket stall with Doom and asked, I was wondering if Doom works for exams. And even South Africa's Sports Minister Mbalula Fikile tweeted, the pastor is giving a whole new meaning to the phrase prophet of doom. And to crown it all, at just two tweeted, if you think you've seen it all, wait till I open my church next year. I will heal with Jack Daniels.
That's a brand of whiskey, bourbon, if I'm not mistaken.
That is right. Well, basically, the Doom Prophet story led many people to start questioning the role of some of the so-called modern prophets. One Twitter user who goes by the name at Simfiwe Petros said, the Doom Prophet just really capped off 2016. I'm done with this year. Take me to 2017 already.
He'll have to wait a few weeks yet. A reminder of our main stories. The Nigerian military say they are launching a new operation against Boko Haram in Zambeza Forest. Crisis-ridden Burundi has appointed a new ombudsman. And there's tension in Zimbabwe over the introduction of bond notes. From me, Mark Caldwell.
And from me, Crispin Makideu.
Bye now.